Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Breast cancer, mastectomies, mostly women's territory, but not always. Erica Newbert Campbell shared her journey from fear to healing and vitality with words and pictures. Her book is vital reading for anyone going through this journey, supporting someone on this journey, or fearful of the journey. I think for the first time ever, we talked about the book at length, never once telling you the title. The mastectomy I always wanted may not be for the weak of heart, but it very much is for the strong of constitution and those determined to survive their trip through the operating room and thrive. Listen now. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. As we get older, many of us are aware that we may have dodged the cancer bullet for this many years, but there are no guarantees. And many of you know only too well the fear, the pain, the devastation that cancer can bring. Hopefully, you also know the relief that prevailing brings. My guest today is the latter. It's her story, so I'm not going to say too much, but I will tell you I inhaled her book in one sitting, accompanied by a box of tissues. Many of you will relate. Frightening, life-altering news that you get to share with family, friends, co-workers, and, hardest of all, as a daughter, a wife, and a mother to small people. Erica Newbert Campbell, I have my box of tissues. I just showed it to you. Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast.
Thank you so much, Agnes. I'm really delighted to be here.
Well, your cancer story does not start with you. Tell us about your mom.
Yeah. My mom was one of those women. She was diagnosed in her 50s. And it started off what I would call as breast cancer light. Her doctors thought it was really a cancer that was curable. And she originally started out with a lumpectomy just to take out the small pea-sized tumor in her left breast. But unfortunately, that tumor had different plans, and it was relentless. No matter what surgery or chemotherapy or radiation she had, it kept coming back over and over again. And we went through a really challenging 4.5 year roller coaster battle, and eventually the breast cancer took her life. And it was really a startling time for me about, you know, having to trust so many other people in the journey, but also to really watch someone you care about struggle. And that stayed with me for a really long time. I was with her when she took her last breath. I held her hand. I told her it was okay to let go. And that changed me as a person.
Yeah. And I think from my age, we couldn't hope for more in passing. So.
Yeah, actually, you know, even though it was the most challenging moment of my life, I equally call it the most beautiful part of my life, because the opportunity to be there with her in that moment was a gift that she ultimately gave me.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to volunteer at hospice, so I hear you.
Yeah, you know.
Now hindsight is always 20/20. I found myself getting really angry with that doctor who suggested your mom may have lived if she'd chosen mastectomy over lumpectomy.
Yes. I remember hearing that statement. It was an offhand comment from a rotating physician who had come to see her kind of in her last year of life. And I remember he walked out and I was like, whoa. Because the pain of regret was setting in even before, you know, she passed away. And, you know, looking in the rearview mirror is always really hard. And questioning yourself and questioning your decisions. So thank you for being angry for all of us in that moment. And it has, that comment has haunted me for most of my life. In fact, I actually was just talking with a woman this week who also read the book and said, that must have been really hard, and I wished your mom had a mastectomy. And it's hard. It's really hard.
I can be violent on occasion. I would have slapped him. Do you want me to go find him now?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I like you. I'll do this for you.
Yeah. But I think that moment also started this powerful moment of like, oh, you have to advocate for yourself. Right. And I don't know that I felt it in that moment, but over time, and then, you know, just my own health journeys, you know, not just with my own diagnosis, but even being pregnant or, you know, having children, you know, going to the pediatrician with your child, you really do have to advocate for yourself and do the research.
Well, that said, I remember years ago, a friend saying to me that a bad decision was basically the best available data. And yes. Your mother made a decision that it seemed the right decision, the perfectly obvious decision. You know, so it's only in hindsight that you say, oh, gee, Mom, I wish you'd chosen something else, you know. So,
thank you. That's a really healing comment, Agnes. And I really appreciate that about that perspective. It was the best decision at the time.
Yeah.
And I would agree with that. That's what my mom felt about it. You know, we did talk at length with her during those times, and she still stood by that decision up until the end. And I will give her that credit for not having the bitterness. She didn't die with bitterness. And that was her spunk. That was her spirit. That was her self-belief.
Yeah. Gee, you're not like your mom at all, are you? Okay, let's get the housekeeping out of the way. Your mom had a lumpectomy. We've all heard of mastectomies. You opted for double mastectomy. Can you just explain to our listeners the difference and why a person might choose one over the other?
Yes. So a lumpectomy is where, if it's an option, there might be a small tumor or a small spot in a breast where they can just remove, kind of as it says, just the lump around it. So imagine it's like scooping out, you know, like a little piece of cantaloupe out of your boob. Right? It's just, it takes a small piece of it. Now, sometimes that lumpectomy can be a rather large piece, but the intent is to make sure you get all of the cancer. That's why they take, you know, just a little bit more outside of the actual cancer. They want to make sure the margins around it are clear, but it's not taking the whole breast. It's just taking a portion of the breast that has that cancerous piece. Of course, that preserves the breasts. It's a much easier surgery, although not particularly comfortable itself, but it just takes out that, you know, the small piece of the breast. Now, mastectomy is obviously a removal of both breasts, taking out all of the tissue, sometimes removing nipples. I mean, really just removal of that body part. And, you know, the difference between the two, obviously, one is significantly more invasive in terms of a surgery, but they both come with pros and cons. The lumpectomy may be easier in the moment. It also is not as challenging, but with the lumpectomy comes continual screening, and you have to continually watch to make sure, like my mother, it doesn't come back. Mastectomy, it's probably, you know, a lot more challenging in the beginning. But, you know, I can't relapse with breast cancer now because I don't have any breasts. I mean, I have reconstructed fake ones, but the chances of my relapse are so minuscule that was, you know, sort of, for me, it became a mental game and a mental decision between those two.
And I wonder, too, speaking of hindsight, your mom chose a lumpectomy. If she had gone more drastic, perhaps her doctor would have said, oh, you're overreacting. You know, it's just this little tiny pea-sized thing. We got this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the advice that she got at the time. And I really appreciate you saying it was the best advice she had at the time. And it did start really small. And so I understand why she did that.
I'm going to get into the weeds now. And if I get too deep into the weeds and you don't want to go there, just say, let's go for coffee.
I love the weeds. Okay. I love the weeds.
I had a very brief cancer scare when my kids were young teens. It turned out not to be cancer, so I mean, I just want to assert that right now. But my buckets of tears were about my children launching into the world without me, me never knowing who they fell in love with, me, the worst part, never ever knowing my grandchildren. What was your experience when you were first diagnosed? Yours were littler.
Yeah, mine were 4 and 8 at the time, and they were really little. And I would absolutely agree with that bucket of tears. You know, as moms, as grandmothers, it's not about us. It was really about, oh my gosh, I don't want my children to have the same pain that I had of losing my mom. You know, I lost my mom when I was 29. And so the thought of them losing potentially me at even a much younger age, that was really frightening. And my son was too young. He was the four-year-old, but my daughter was eight. And she knew enough to understand that cancer was serious. She'd heard the word before. You know, she knew that her grandmother, you know, my mother had passed away from it. So she had a lot of fears. And that was a really challenging time to have to explain that to her in an age-appropriate way. You know, I had to say to her things like, I'm going to be okay. But truthfully, I didn't know that. And it's really hard to have those challenging conversations.
A few years before I had my cancer scare, three moms in our neighborhood, in our circle, died of various types of cancer. And it was so scary for all the kids realizing that if their mom could die and their mom was healthy and fit and all the rest of it, like that became very scary for all the kids. So we had a really concerted, probably 2 years of just, you know, like isolated event. But yeah. It really, really does bring it home that they're little tiny people.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I'm glad you were honest with your kids. And, you know, I think you said they were teenagers when...
Oh, they didn't. I don't think they know now. If they listen to this episode, they're going to find out.
Well, they're probably very happy you're healthy. But yeah, it can be triggering to think, to see other people and think, oh my gosh, is that going to happen to me?
Yeah. Yeah.
That happens to me all the time. When I hear about other people who get secondary cancers, you know, I have to have this mantra of like, everyone is unique. That's not my story. Yeah. I actually worked with a therapist on that one.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it's so easy to own. Like when you've walked that walk, I'm sure it's easy to own other people's stories if they're on a parallel road.
Absolutely. Yes.
Do you mind if I ask what you did tell your children, 4 and 8?
Yeah. Well, like I said, for my four-year-old, you know, it was a lot of really higher level language. It was around, mommy has to go to the hospital and I will be gone for 3 days, but I will be back. And then we had to say, which is the most painful thing, and when mommy's back, she may not be able to give you a hug. And, my son, you know, he was like mama's boy. He still is. And, you know, to tell him not to hug, he was like, what? And he didn't understand. And I talk about this in the book. I mean, the most painful part was having to push him away when he would come running to give me that big giant bear hug that he was known for. And that was really traumatic for him and for me. You know, for my daughter, really interesting. She was, you know, I think women or not women, but, you know, young girls are wiser than their years. And so even my daughter said, you know, am I going to get cancer? Right. Knowing that her grandmother had breast cancer, that her mom had breast cancer now, and, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 for her. And so I really had to assure her, and I had to be honest, like, it's possible, but, you know, right now there's a lot of good breast cancer research. Also, we're going to make sure that, you know, you get lots of checks from the doctor. And I still had to be age appropriate for her at 8 years old, but she's the one we let come into the hospital. And, you know, to this day, my daughter remains incredibly compassionate and empathetic just across the board. And I do wonder if that experience, you know, it's kind of rare for an 8-year-old to see your mother, A, in a hospital bed or, you know, really struggling. I struggled to get out of bed. You know, I think that gave her a perspective that perhaps sent her on a different trajectory in terms of her compassion for others and her compassion for other people in cancer journeys.
Well, you started by saying women in terms of her. No, but what I was going to say is the pictures in the book. I mean, other than the age difference, you did just look like two besties because she seemed to model, and like there was a picture of her in the chair with the blanket and stuff like that, resembling you in the bed with the blanket, you know. Yeah. So, she, you know, just sort of, I can do this with you, Mom.
Exactly. I mean, she really... I hate to say this word, but she like rose to the challenge, you know? And that's where I sort of joked that she was a woman, because she really, not always, but in that moment, matured so fast. I do think that's what cancer does to a kid, whether the child has cancer or has a family member with cancer. It does mature them quite significantly.
I was thinking with your four-year-old too, that they live so much in the moment that when you tell a little person like that, that they can't hug mommy, it's like, they think it's forever and ever. They can't hug mommy, you know? And it's like, oh no, like life as we know it is definitely changing.
So, yeah. And you know, he didn't understand. And I actually remember, you know, because of the surgery and they cut into my chest muscles, it was very challenging to use my upper body, like my arms. You don't realize how much your chest muscles are impacted by your arms. And he still wanted me to hold him, right? He was young enough that, you know, you'd want him to carry him on your hip. And I just simply could not do that. So I remember I would put him on my back and he would put his arms around my neck. I'm like, you know, half choking. And then I could just, you know, put my arms around his legs behind me. But I mean, I was like, oh, I'm going to find a way to do this, because he didn't understand, but at least he could be close to me that way. And I think of that as like, you know, the mother's gift, right? I was like half choking and like really struggling with my arms anyway, but I still wanted him close and I didn't want to have to push him away. That's the hardest part.
Okay, all you listeners who aren't moms, welcome to the world of momhood. You always figure out a way to hold those babies.
So messy sometimes, but I mean, moms are miracles. I'd lift a car if I could, if I needed to, you know.
Well, apparently women have.
Yes, that's what I've heard. Yes.
Yeah.
Now I understand that. Now I understand it.
I made up that story I'm just kidding. Now, chapter one opens with you writing, waiting for test results is the worst. I remember seeing a flower bloom and wondering if it would be the last spring I saw flowers bloom. Did you go through that as well?
Oh, for sure. When you're in that waiting period, and this is when I coach any woman who's, you know, like you may have been in this place when you thought you had a cancer scare, that waiting, your mind goes into such dark places. And it's so easy to spiral down to, what if, what if, what if, what's next, what's next, what's next? And yeah, I mean, especially, you know, because of my mom's journey, I mean, it all flashed before my eyes. And I thought, is this the beginning of the end? You know, and then, I mean, I could barely process it, even though you kind of half expect it. But that waiting period, I find to be the most challenging for anybody in a health journey, is that period between when you take the diagnostic test and when you get the results. I mean, oof, that takes the will of like 1,000 tigers to not stress about it, to check your phone, to check your health portal. That I find to be the most challenging part. Once you get the news, whether it's positive or negative, then at least you can take action. Right. Once you know, and you're like, okay, all right, I know the size of the beast and now I'm going to go tackle it. But when you don't know the size of the beast or the problem that you're facing, whoo, that is such a mental journey that can really, I think that's the worst part.
I've said on several occasions to somebody who has had whatever the diagnosis is, you have that now, and now you know exactly what direction you need to go, you know, and what education you need, and you can move forward once you have a diagnosis and start making choices. But there's no choices to be made when you're in limbo.
Exactly. So true. And I do think that like forward action reduces fear, right? Because at least you're doing something. But you're so right, Agnes. In that limbo period, there are no choices because you don't know what you're doing. Yeah.
Now, most of us have heard of the BRCA gene. You tested negative, which suggests that test is not as reliable as some professionals would have us believe. Now, I'm going to remind our listeners that you are a participant, not a medical professional. But can you speak to that from your experience?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And thank you. Yes, I am not a doctor. I'm not a physician, but I have been through all of this. So as a layperson, what I can say is, yes, I did test negative for the BRCA gene, which, you know, if you do have the BRCA gene, there is a like near 70% chance that you will get breast or ovarian cancer. And so that's why the BRCA gene is very dangerous. And that's why I do encourage that genetic testing for anybody, because I do think knowledge is power. So I did do the test and I was negative. I was surprised, right? But I will say that I hate to tell this, I assumed I was going to get cancer. I did. And just because of what I'd seen from my mom's journey, I was like, oh, I bet that's coming for me, you know, and whether I manifested it or I'm a fortune teller by secret trade, I don't know. But I was glad to say that I got tested for all of the markers. So what that means is in the genetic testing, you can choose, you can get tested for the genes for, you know, colon cancer and lung cancer and all of these other diseases. So I'm glad I did that. And they were all negative, which was a relief. I did have to go to genetic counseling before you get the results, because, you know, just because you have a gene doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get any of those diseases. But I'm really glad I did it, because again, knowledge is power. And I actually had I had a happy hour yesterday with a woman who had a BRCA gene, and she did have a preventative mastectomy because the chances of her getting breast cancer were so high. So we had a lot in common in that. Still think that the double mastectomy probably saved our lives.
Now you talk about Angelina Jolie in your book, and I remember that she took a lot of flack for her op-ed in the New York Times, but you credit her with opening the door to the concept of a preventative double mastectomy.
Yes, I read that article from Angelina Jolie with such veracity. I was like, it opened my eyes. I didn't even know that it was a possibility. And then my mom was, I think had just passed away when I read that article, and I was like, oh, that's what I want. I want to have a preventative mastectomy, even though at the time I didn't even know if I had the BRCA gene or not. I was so traumatized what I'd seen my mom go through that I was like, you know, these two breasts, like, I don't need them. I don't need them, right? Like, they're not a life-giving organ like my eyes or my ears or my arms. And, you know, I started to think, well, hey, Angelina Jolie looks pretty good. So why don't I just do that? Swap out the fake ones for these real ones that could potentially kill me. And I mean, in all seriousness, I did go to my OBGYN and my physicians and say, could I get a preventative mastectomy? I did ask several times, and they were like, no, you don't need it. You have just the same probability as anybody else in the population. Don't worry about it. That's too aggressive. I mean, I probably brought it up, I'm not joking, 3 to 4 times. And by the time when I was diagnosed, I did make the joke, which is the joke's on me. When I went into my biopsy, I was like, hey, when are you guys going to let me have a preventative mastectomy? And we all laughed. It's true. And then when the radiologist who did my biopsy had to call me and say that it was actually breast cancer this time, I mean, the joke was over, and I obviously was no longer a preventative mastectomy. It became a life-saving one.
Now, you also say in your book, deciding what to do next is like choosing a deadly weapon when I didn't pick the battle. Yeah. That says so much, but I want you to add to it.
Right. I remember, I mean, when you get diagnosed, so many choices come at you. It's like drinking from a fire hose. And I remember, you know, they were saying, well, do you want the lumpectomy, the mastectomy? And if you do that, what kind of reconstruction? And we went on and on and on and on. And I was like, I don't want to make these choices. This is not, I didn't choose this. And it was like staring at all of these deadly weapons. And I was like, you're all making me choose one of these? I don't even want to be here. And it was that, you know, frankly, self-pity. I didn't want to have to make those choices. You know, I sound really confident and powerful now. Yes, it's been 6 years. At the time, I was broken. I was terrified. I was fearful. I was angry. all of these emotions. And so that statement of like, I didn't want to choose this. I didn't choose this. And I don't even want to choose the weapons, but I know we got to slay this dragon. Darn it.
Well, I just scrolled forward in my notes because you talk about the pain post-op. And that's where I said, you know, like you hear about women in the middle of childbirth saying, can I just come back tomorrow, finish this tomorrow, you know?
Like, right. Time out.
Yeah, exactly. Was there ever a time when you thought like, oh, crap, like this is just too much, you know? I mean, maybe I'm going to change my mind, even though they're gone. The girls are gone. But
yeah. Oh, for sure. I don't know if I fully questioned it, but I was like, I give up. The pain, you know. Again, I just want to be clear. I don't know that this pain is common for every woman who has a double mastectomy, but I had a shooting pain under where my left breast formerly was that felt like I was being stabbed with like a jagged knife. And I mean, it was debilitating. I think they ended up thinking that they may have nicked a nerve, and that's probably why anytime I moved. So as I say, I don't want to worry women that that's always the case, but it was so disheartening because the physician kept saying, I don't understand why you're in this much pain. I was like, I don't either, but it's there. And I mean, it really felt like I was being tortured. I mean, I thought about torture victims, prisoners of war. I was like, I'll give you any secret, whatever you want. You know, it would cause me to like crumple on the floor. And, you know, also my daughter was in the room. I'm trying to hide it. I'm, you know, literally biting the inside of my cheek. I didn't regret it, but I was really resigned.
And I will emphasize to our listeners too, that just listen to all that and they're going like, oh crap, forget it.
I know.
You say in the book that it really puzzled the professionals in the room. So yes. It sounds like it was an anomaly. And
exactly.
You may or may not ever know sort of why.
Exactly. Yeah, we may never know why. But I will say, despite that excruciating pain and, you know, it was hard to even touch my nose, my finger to my nose, I still am so grateful. And I know that sounds weird. I am so happy today about it. Yeah. Because yes, I wouldn't wish that pain on my worst enemy. However, we survived the saying goes, you've survived 100% of your worst days. And now I'm free from the fear. So I would trade, you know, the fear versus the pain. The fear is forever. The pain was temporary.
Okay, I'm gonna get to your surgery in a second. But in the book, before you got into all that, you talked about how you and your husband chose to communicate with everybody. So it sounds like the first notification came from you, and then after that, it was like it's Ian's bailiwick.
Yes, yeah,
which makes so much sense.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as, you know, your friends and family find out, of course, everybody wants to know the details and they want to support you. And that's so loving. And yet it is also so overwhelming. And, you know, I was dealing mentally with so many, as we talked about, fears, anxieties, and, you know, just to pick up your phone and see there's like 35 text messages. I was like, I can't do this anymore. And so it was a very conscious choice between my husband and I. And I was like, I'm going to send this one communication and I'm out. And then it's all you. And you can filter to me, you know, what I need to know. But right now I need to focus inward. I need to build my own resilience. Because there was a lot of loving people who sent very loving messages. And, you know, unfortunately, there were always some people that maybe said the thing that would like, ugh, just trigger me just a little bit. You know, you always have that one friend or family member that you're like, did you just say that? And I wanted to protect, myself and my relationships from that. Yeah. And so, you know, actually I consulted another friend of mine. She was like, oh, this is the plan. We're going to do an FAQ document because everybody's curious and they all get, you know, they all want to know. And then every communication goes through your husband. And it was so freeing once we did that. Yeah, that's my biggest recommendation.
I did appreciate the fact you said, please don't send flowers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. No. Yeah,
let's have a whole house full of things that are dying as I'm trying desperately to live.
Exactly. That is the worst feeling. Oh, yes. Well, having to then throw out dying flowers when you are trying to live. No.
Yeah. No. Oh, dear. Talk just briefly, if you don't mind, about I call it a transition from what you seem to identify as before to whatever comes next. Because in the beginning, what comes next was just a speculation for you. But I'm thinking of things like yoga, standing in front of a mirror saying goodbye to your breasts. It sounds like a real passage, like within a life.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the greatest gifts I got was I got coaching from another woman. And she, you know, this is actually why I wrote this book, because I want to be this resource for other women. I want to reach back and help others. This woman took me under her wing. And she actually really coached me. She said, I want you to have a ceremony. And I was like, what do you mean a ceremony? She was like, I want you to say goodbye to your boobs. And she was like, and it's private. This is not a ceremony for other people, not even your husband. This is for you. And I really resonated with that. I mean, it wasn't a lengthy ceremony, but, you know, it was like, say thank you to your boobs. They did a lot of good work, right? You know, they were beautiful and they gave milk and, you know, life to your children. Say thank you and say it's time to go. And I found that to be really comforting. You know, I took some selfie pictures by myself too. She actually suggested I get a professional photographer. And I was like, I can't go there. She's like, okay. Well, then just take some selfies. She's like, you might want to remember, you know? And I said, okay. And then she also said, on the day before your surgery, I want you to do everything that you're worried that you can't do in the future. And I want you to treat yourself. And I want you to just focus on you. And as a mom, that's hard to do, right? Because we're always taking care of other humans, whether they be big or small. And so I really protected that day. And I protected that moment. And I said to my family and to my husband, I'm going to need the house by myself for like a couple of hours. And they really respected that. And I think that also gave me so much peace. And, you know, on those private moments alone, you know, it's also, you don't get a lot of alone moments as a woman too. And, you know, was I scared? Yes. But at least I felt like I had the opportunity to say goodbye.
And you'll excuse me laughing, but after you telling me about your namesake and then a professional photographer taking pictures of your breasts, I will leave exactly. It like that and have everybody just wonder what we're talking about.
I know. Well, I will mention that there is another Erica Campbell out there that's a former porn star. So there you go. Yes, that is not me. That is not me. Do not Google ericacampbell.com.
You just gave her a big rave review here. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the book. And I want you to talk about this book because there are no holds barred. There are like, is it 50 photographs of your entire journey? And you describe post-surgery in detail. That it was so valuable. It scared the bejesus out of me, but... You know, like I'd rather go in saying, oh, crap, this isn't going to be nice, than going in saying, I can do this and, you know, like I'll be back to my life next week.
Yeah. Oh, I have so much to say about this. I think vulnerability is a superpower and authenticity is one of my highest values. And so when I went into these surgical conversations, I remember asking my surgeon, okay, so you're telling me what you're going to do. And you're telling me that this is how I'm going to look afterwards, but I don't really know what you're talking about. Can you show me a photo? And he said, you know, we don't have any. I said, you don't have any photos? I was like, what? He's like, well, you know, most women really don't want us to share those. And, you know, they don't really feel comfortable with that. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. At this point, you know, I've had to show my breasts to like 6 or 7 people, you know, coming in the room. There's the nurses, there's the radiologists, like, you know. And so I was like, oh, interesting. But I also had this really beautiful experience, and I do talk about this in the book, where When I announced that I had had breast cancer, a woman at my office that I barely knew, so someone who was new to our team, pulled me aside and she said, "Hey, I know this is weird, but I've had a similar surgery several years ago, and would you like to see my boobs today?" And I was like, okay, this is a professional setting. You work for me. I don't really know you as well, but yes. And, you know, we went off to a bathroom far off the beaten path, locked the door, and she took off her shirt and she showed me her chest. And her boobs looked so real, and her scars were so faint. It gave me so much hope that I was like, oh my gosh, my mindset totally shifted in that moment. But of course, I also understood it was so rare. And what are the chances that a near stranger would be willing to show me her breasts in such a vulnerable moment of her own? And so it didn't occur to me right away, but you know, over the months and months after my healing, I would get calls, text messages from friends who said, "Oh, hey, my neighbor's just been diagnosed. Can you help her out? You know, my sister's been diagnosed. Can you talk to her?" And I found myself literally texting these photos to women who would say, "Oh my gosh, thank you so much. This is so helpful." And so while yes, it is no holds barred, and you know, I am I'm a career woman, I'm a, you know, upstanding mother in the community, but I'm willing to take the risk to share these photos because I do believe that it is going to help lots of women. And my intention is to really normalize the conversation and make it okay to talk about these things, because you know, like in the social media world today, everybody looks all so hunky-dory and everybody looks so happy. And, you know, we all want to believe that's true, but it is. I wanted to be honest about the struggle, and I wanted to make it okay for women to see what it's like on the other side and to know that it's going to be okay.
Well, and to see what it's like going through it.
Yes.
Because, you know, you could conceivably have said to your doctor, "You've seen this before and you didn't tell me, you didn't give me that information." Whereas right. Now, as frightening, for lack of a better word, as some of your pictures are en route.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, yeah. It's like, that's reality. And look at you now, girl. You know, you look fabulous. And
I wish your listeners could see them. I guess really beautiful.
I'm going to turn the video on.
Exactly. Turn the video on. You know, and I it's so funny. I remember you had to go for your second appointment after the surgery. And for those of you who haven't seen the book yet, my chest looks like Frankenstein. It really does. It is ugly. There are big scars. They're uneven. And A, I was wondering, is this normal? But B, I'm like, what is this going to look like? And the nurse practitioner comes in, she looks at it, she goes, "Oh, this is so good. This looks like amazing work. You're going to love this in the end." And I looked down at myself and I was like, "Are you on crack?" I mean, it literally looked like, you know, a 5-year-old had stitched these up. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I appreciate what you just said, but are you lying to me and just trying to make me feel better?" Because again, you know, Agnes, you've seen the pictures. It did not look pretty. And she said, "Oh, no. Trust me. It's going to look great." And I mean, I think I asked that question probably for the next 5 or 6 check-in appointments. And they kept saying, "Oh, no, this is on track. It's going to be great." And it wasn't until 6 to 12 months later that I was like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I see where you're heading on this." And so again, I wanted the book to be able to show that progression, to say, yeah, it is going to be okay. It's going to look a little bit wonky at first, but you know, trust yourself, trust the surgeons. You're going to look beautiful in the end.
Well, they tell us that even the original girls aren't the exact same as each other. So,
right? Exactly. Nobody's perfect. Show me a woman, you know, who feels perfect about their bodies and I'll show you a liar. You know, I mean, and actually I still have some faint scars. I went through all sorts of treatments to get the scars, try to reduce them. And now I'm like, you know what? They're beautiful the way they are. It's just a scar and it shows how resilient you are.
If you don't mind me asking, what went into your decision to have implants?
Great question. You know, I if I was being very honest, I would probably say it was a little bit of social pressure and vanity, right? You know, after having these breasts for X number of years, well, I guess 45 years at the time, I thought, you know what, I'm going to at least try to look the way I did before. You know, and I did come back to my mom. So she went during her years of relapse, they did eventually recommend a mastectomy for her. And she opted for a single mastectomy without reconstruction, which means she had one real breast and then one just completely removed fake. And even then, she would put on a real bra and we would literally stuff the empty part of her bra with whatever we could find, whether it be a sock. We eventually got like a real, you know, sort of a prosthetic fake breast that was kind of like a big, you know, round gummy bear. But even then, I remember she would say, I still want to look beautiful in a tight sweater, you know, like the nice turtleneck sweaters that you wear. And I was like, okay, you know, but interestingly, after I went through I had the mastectomy and I, you know, the reconstructive surgery, you don't necessarily in the surgery I had have these fake boobs overnight. I was flat chested for quite some time. I kind of got used to it. And I kind of was like, oh, it's not so bad. I did question. I was like, am I doing this reconstruction just for society or for myself? Yeah, the train had left the station at that point. I was already in the reconstructive process, but I could have stopped it. I didn't. You know, I still wear bathing suits today. I feel great in them. Nobody would know if you didn't, you know, you didn't get up real close and see some of the scars. But yeah, you know, I think it was a choice about femininity and, you know, what we in society look like. I will say the older I get, you know, so these implants I have today will have to get replaced eventually. 10 to 15 years is the shelf life. And, you know, in another 10 years, maybe I don't. Maybe I don't. Because I think the older we get, the more we realize it's not about our bodies. It's about our souls. And we get more comfortable with that.
Yeah, that was my thought, like in reading your book of like, thanks, girls. You've done me well all these years, but you go your way and I'm just going to stay here and not have sweaty underboobs anymore.
Right? Exactly. Exactly. There are some upsides to these changes we've made. Yes.
Oh, yes. Dear. Okay, I've dragged you through a whole bunch of my questions, but I did want to talk to you about a couple of your talking points. What is the silver lining in a breast cancer journey?
Oh gosh. Well, the silver lining, to be honest, is conversations like this. And what I mean by that is there is such a deep authenticity that comes when you face your own fears and when you face the end of your own life. I love the people that I have met through this journey because you really do meet the most compassionate, authentic people that, whether they've been in a cancer journey or not, the ability to have honest conversations about what matters in life, it's probably been the greatest gift. And again, it's like, you know, I would never wish it on my worst enemy, but if I had to go through it, I'm grateful for the people, I'm grateful for the, you know, the awkward conversations that always have a chuckle at the end and the really healthy perspective. There's a lot of things that don't bother me anymore. And, you know, the tangible things in life, the materiality of life doesn't matter. Like, you know, I rarely worry about, you know, the things like the fancy car. Like, I don't care about a fancy car or fancy house because you can't take it with you. You know, those are the kinds of things. And I'm grateful for that perspective.
What advice do you have for women and caregivers facing a mastectomy?
Well, the number one thing I would say, and I hope this isn't offensive, but get the mastectomy. If you are choosing between a lumpectomy and a mastectomy, I feel sometimes awkward saying this, but I really feel strongly about the mental benefits of not worrying about relapse and the release of the fears. And so the advice I would give is also to trust yourself and do your own research. And I can say that, you know, confidently this was the right choice for me, but, you know, well, I would say read the book, and see for yourself too. But trusting yourself is probably my best advice. And there were many people that questioned my decisions. And I had to just say, thank you so much. I appreciate your feedback and my decision stands. And having to trust yourself and having to have those conversations, that's my advice, is whatever it looks like for you. And certainly I can't dictate a person's journey. Trust yourself.
So after all these years, Jane Fonda is finally right. No pain, no gain.
Right? Jane had it right all along.
You're just talking about the wrong things. Oh, dear. Is there anything about your journey I haven't asked you about that you want women to know?
You are not alone. That's the feeling that I had when I was first diagnosed. Even though, you know, I'd been through my mother's journey, you would be surprised. There are so many women out there that have either faced breast cancer, faced a mastectomy. And I would say you are not alone. And that's the thing that I want to really make sure women not only realize, but also reach out, because you do need to create that community. And you have to be vulnerable to share your story to then find others who have a similar journey than you.
My thought as you were saying that is, I hope that's a life lesson. I mean, most women have learned that, but I hope it's a life lesson that men figure out at some point in time too.
Me too. I really agree with that.
Yeah. Open your mouth and talk about it, because you'd be surprised who's wanting to do that too. You know.
Yes.
Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
So you can find me at my website, which is my full name. It is www.ericanewbertcampbell.com. If you do spell it wrong, don't worry. I have them all redirected to the right one. And you can certainly find me on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
Okay. Now you have a thing here, the top 10 tips for preparing for a mastectomy. What's in there? Just like lots of good advice. And
yeah. I mean, I found, as I mentioned, the women who coached me provided me with some really great tangible advice. So I talk about in this top 10 tips, it's obviously, it's about taking, you know, things to do before, right? Including take a picture of your breasts before the surgery. And it is about things like get a recliner. I know this sounds really practical, like really like a tangible thing, but yes, the kind that, you know, you sleep in or sit in. It was really hard for me to get out of, in and out of bed. So having that recliner that kind of helps you was a really powerful tool. And I wanted just to have that practical advice. And it includes things like we talked about, get a lead communicator, find somebody on your care team to be that person that handles all the text messages, the, you know, where do I drop off the food, that kind of stuff. And also asking for help, making sure you get someone to make you meals. It's okay. As women, sometimes we're the one always making the meals. I had somebody making meals and doing my laundry and mowing my lawn. And I was really grateful for that. So it includes really some really practical suggestions. And you can find that not only at the ending chapters of the book, but if you go on my website, you can download that PDF for free.
Right. And I've got the page open here. And there's so many other things too. Just about there's a communication tool where people can update what's going on in your life. And you just drop in there and see what's going on. Support communities.
Yes.
All that. Oh, is it
Caring Bridge? I highly recommend Caring Bridge.
That's the one I just spotted it now, Caring Bridge.
Oh, that's one of the best tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We Caring use that Bridge for one of my clients.
One. Yeah. Meal Train is another great one. Instacart, obviously, too. You know, someone wants to give you a gift card for that. Anything you can do to make your life easier.
Yeah. And as you were saying things about, like, somebody to mow your lawn. I'm sure there's people out there going like, well, couldn't her husband do that? Well, no, your husband's picking up the slack in so many areas, as well as especially parenting.
You exactly. Being, yes.
Yeah, just
he was
there
being
for the
a
children.
Super dad, and so we had a super overgrown lawn.
Now, I chuckled when I read, I can see it here again, do not Google anything, because we talk about Dr. Google all the time. Knowledge is power, but you just don't know who set up that website.
Oh my gosh, that was the best advice I'd been given over and over again. And of course, like any woman who's probably listening today, you do it anyway, right? You like you like dabble in Dr. Google. And I mean, I had to shut down my computer because there's a million different ways that you can slice and dice some of these statistics, and you don't know, you know, what is the real truth and what's just an ad. So, you know, it's coming back to what I said earlier about trusting yourself, trusting your care team, trusting your doctors. You know, if you feel good about your doctor, then you have to trust that person. And that is the best source of advice, trusting on their professional experience. You know, I know people who got second opinions. Great. But just don't Google.
Pregnant pause. What is this Pinky Swear Foundation?
Oh, it is my life passion outside of this book. I laugh. So Pinky Swear Foundation is a nonprofit that helps kids with cancer and their families with financial support. And we keep this Pinky Swear promise. That's how we got our name. So there was a 9-year-old boy who gave away his life savings to other kids with cancer before he died. And he made a pinky swear promise with his dad to keep doing it after he was gone. And so that's what I do in my day job, is I lead this Pinky Swear Foundation, you know, partly because I have seen how cancer can affect a person and a family financially as much as it does physically and emotionally. So in my day job, I keep that pinky swear promise for kids and families nationwide.
And with all due respect, please hear this in the way I mean it, but it's even worse when it's kids.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My mom used to say that. She, even in her dying days, she would say, you know, she knew she was dying. She said, this is really bad, but I am so grateful that I've had a long life. And I don't want this to, you know, she knew the work I was doing. And she was like, it's, you know, as long as it's not with the kids, not cancer with kids.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you a personal question? Not that, like, our whole conversation hasn't been very personal at all.
I'm an open book.
Okay, last week I interviewed a gentleman from your neck of the woods, and I asked him where in the land of 10,000 lakes he'd recommend we go for a nice resort weekend if we come down to Minnesota.
Oh, that is an amazing question. I have an answer. So if you're willing to go the distance, I highly recommend Walker, Minnesota. It's on the shores of Leech Lake, which I know it's called Leech Lake, but there's no leeches, I don't think, in the lake, which is a little disturbing.
Guess we'd find
really
it.
Cute town, right on the water, not overcrowded, and it is just heaven on earth, in my opinion. It's got nature trails, year-round access to those trails, too. Cute shopping, great restaurants, and beautiful sunsets.
Now, he said the Brainerd area. Is that nearby?
Yes, it is like an hour north of the Brainerd area.
So you gotta
go the distance. But I will say the Brainerd area is lovely too.
Yeah. Well, what I said to him, and I'll say to you too, is I used to work with a woman who worked out of Minneapolis, and flying in, it's like, there's like all these lakes and these cottages and boats. And on a sunny day, it was just like, I just want to live here forever. It was just, it was pretty spectacular.
Yes. You know, they say that in Minnesota, it's really hard to recruit somebody to live here. But once they get here, it's really hard to ask them to leave. Because it is, yes, it's cold here, but it is not that bad. And it is a lovely, lovely place to live. And the lakes really make a difference.
There we go. Okay. We'll conclude. Your website link is in the show notes, and all of your links are on your page at our website.
Wonderful.
Listeners, if you have thoughts on today's show, please talk to us. Last year, Katie Snyder talked about her own special brand of humor around breast cancer. And in 2022, Jamie Sherling discussed her decision to go flat and how the drag community helped her stay glam during that journey. I love the look on your face as I said that.
That's cool.
Yeah. Most of us know someone who walked this path, so leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. If there's a question I didn't ask Erica, ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. And share this episode. I started the conversation by saying that many of us are aware that we may have dodged the cancer bullet for this many years. But there are no guarantees. With people like Erica sharing her journey, complete with photos, it may not be any less scary, but we will have some idea of what to expect. Do your friends that favor by sharing. Finally, leave stars and reviews where you can. I'm on a mission this fall and winter to get more boomer women listening to podcasts. So let's keep the algorithm goddesses happy. A reminder that you can support this podcast by buying me a coffee. That link is in the show notes and above Erica's head on her page at our website. And I've also registered at Substack. Following there is free. Erica Newbert Campbell, thank you for being my guest today and being so open about your own experience and sharing really valuable information about your breast cancer journey.
Thank you so much. And I'm willing to connect with any woman who needs support. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to connect today.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the week.